212, der Amerika-Podcast aus New York. Mit dem Host Sebastian Moll spricht heute Sabine Baumann. Wir wollen uns heute unterhalten über eine Neuerscheinung, nämlich das Buch Fatherland von Burkhard Bilger. Wie bist du auf dieses Buch gekommen, Sebastian?
Ja, das Buch ist vor ungefähr 3 Wochen in den USA, in New York erschienen, und sobald die ersten Kritiken irgendwie in den Zeitungen standen, in der New York Times, haben sehr viele von meinen Freunden mir das geschickt und mir das nahegelegt, dass ich mir das sofort holen soll. Das Buch, weil es um eine Geschichte geht, die mir selber sehr nahe ist. Also der Autor Burkhard Bilger, der ist regelmäßiger Autor im New Yorker, ist Deutsch-Amerikaner, das heißt...
hört man ja schon am Namen, Burkhard Bilger.
Das hört man schon am Namen. Das heißt also, er ist zwar in den USA, in Oklahoma, geboren worden, aber seine Eltern sind aus Deutschland eingewandert und kamen aus dem Schwarzwald. Und ihn hat jetzt interessiert, er hat nachgeforscht, was seine Eltern, beziehungsweise vor allen Dingen sein Großvater, während der Nazi-Zeit gemacht hat und wer er war, was ja eigentlich ein sehr deutsches Unternehmen ist. Das machen ja, glaube ich, in Deutschland viele, auch wenn sie dann keine Bücher drüber schreiben. Aber Leute unserer Generation interessiert es natürlich, was unsere Eltern gemacht haben und wie unsere Familie sich zu der Nazi-Zeit und der Nazi-Zeit verhalten hat. Und er hat aber darüber ein Buch für das amerikanische Publikum gesprochen. Und die Parallelen sozusagen zu meiner eigenen Biografie, die waren also so fast unheimlich. Also seine Eltern haben nur wenige Kilometer von dem Ort entfernt gelebt, in dem Familie meines Vaters gelebt hat im Schwarzwald, und sein Großvater, um den es geht in diesem Buch, ist dann während der Besatzungszeit der Deutschen von Frankreich, also ab 1940, ist er ins Elsass geschickt worden und hat dort eine Schule übernommen. Dann hat er als Schulleiter gearbeitet und war dann auch Parteichef, Nazi-Parteichef in dem Ort, das die Deutschen besetzt hatten. Und das ist eben ganz parallel zu meiner Geschichte, weil mein Großvater während der Nazi-Zeit und der deutschen Besetzung des Elsass im Elsass ein Sägewerk übernommen hat, also als Besatzer. Und deswegen hat mich das natürlich brennend interessiert und ich habe mich dann gleich auf das Buch gestürzt.
Ja, kein Wunder, dass deine Freunde dir das alle empfohlen haben. Die konnten wahrscheinlich nicht diese ganzen Details wissen, dass es da so eine direkte räumliche Parallele gab oder historische Parallele auch. Natürlich ist es aber wahrscheinlich doch anders für einen Amerikaner, sich mit der Genealogie oder Familiengeschichte zu befassen. Vielleicht bleiben wir erst noch mal kurz bei dem Burkhard Bilger, was für ihn der Auslöser eigentlich war. Er hat sich ja nicht von Anfang an mit Familiengeschichte beschäftigt, oder?
Nein, überhaupt nicht. Also er ist wie gesagt, er ist unser Alter noch ein bisschen älter. Also er ist Anfang 60 und er hat sich lange Zeit gar nicht so mit der Familiengeschichte beschäftigt, jedenfalls nicht journalistisch. Der ist Musikjournalist in erster Linie und Reportageschreiber. Und er hat auch gesagt, für uns, wie wir in Deutschland sozialisiert werden, ist ja sozusagen die Nazi-Vergangenheit der Eltern der Vorgängergeneration von Anfang an irgendwie identitätsbildend und identitätsstiftend. Aber er hat gesagt, in seiner Familie als Exildeutsche in Amerika war das gar nicht so sehr im Vordergrund. Er hat gesagt, es wurde zwar schwäbischer Dialekt, alemannisch zu Hause gesprochen auch, und es gab Spätzle, aber dass jetzt sozusagen drüber gesprochen wurde, was habt ihr während der Nazi-Zeit gemacht und die Nazi-Zeit verarbeitet war, das war im Exil Oklahoma überhaupt nicht Thema. Da hat er erst angefangen, sich in der Universität damit zu beschäftigen, und er hat gesagt, so richtig sich dann da in die Tiefe zu gehen, das hat ihn eigentlich erst angefangen zu interessieren, als er selber Kinder hat und die angefangen haben, Fragen zu stellen.
Ja, interessant. Ja. Und dieses, dass die Kinder Fragen stellen, das kennen wir als Deutsche, ne? Also erstens sind wir selber die Kinder, die ihre Eltern gefragt haben. Ich erinnere mich, wir mussten in der Schule ein Buch lesen, warum warst du in der Hitlerjugend? Und dann sollten wir die Eltern oder Großeltern befragen nach diesen Dingen. Du hast es vorhin auch schon angesprochen, dass man als Deutscher sich mit der Vergangenheit ja viel eher nochmal beschäftigt oder auf eine andere Art vielleicht auch als die Amerikaner, weil man sich dafür interessiert, habe ich entweder jüdische Wurzeln oder haben meine Eltern irgendwie Widerstand geleistet, oder muss ich mich damit konfrontieren, dass eben die Nazi-Zeit, dass meine Familie daran mitgewirkt hat. Das ist natürlich ein ganz anderer Ausgangspunkt nochmal.
Ja, auf jeden Fall. Und er sagt, er hat dann auch viel darüber gesprochen und da kommen wir später dazu. In dem Interview mit ihm, das ich geführt habe, ist aus der Distanz in Amerika, da gibt es so eine moralische Klarheit. Da war also immer in der Kultur verwurzelt, die Nazis waren das absolut Böse und damit war das Thema erledigt, während wir das ja kennen, dass es dann eine moralische Komplexität auch gibt, ne? Dass wir also diese Menschen als Familienmitglieder kennen und du merkst, weißt, das gibt kein absolut Böses und wie haben die sich verhalten und warum haben die sich so verhalten? Das ist ja die Neugier, die wir sozusagen hatten. Und das ist, glaube ich, auch das Interessante an dem Buch für den amerikanischen Markt, dass es da so moralische Grauzonen gibt und dass er eben auch mit sehr viel Empathie seinen Großvater beschreibt, einerseits und andererseits war er eben dann doch Parteichef und war Parteimitglied der ersten Stunde von 1933. Und das macht eben diese Spurensuche auch so spannend für ihn. Und das Buch ist also so sehr die Geschichte seines Großvaters wie die Geschichte dieser Spurensuche und seiner Neugier und ein bisschen auch der Angst davor, was er vielleicht findet und wie er damit eben umgeht. Ja.
Wie würdest du das einordnen, bevor man das im Interview dann selber hört? Die Kinder der Kriegskinder, das hat ja in Deutschland auch zu einigen Publikationen geführt oder da gibt es ja einige Leute, die sich damit auseinandergesetzt haben. Wie würdest du ihn da einordnen? Kann man das so pauschal sagen?
Ja, ich meine, er trägt natürlich, wenn das Buch auf Deutsch erscheinen würde, was noch nicht klar ist, ob es in Deutsch erscheint, würde das natürlich zu dieser Literatur der Kinder, der Kriegskinder dazugehören, die ja in Deutschland existiert und die in Deutschland auch wächst, wo in den letzten 20 Jahren man beginnt, an diesem Tabu zu rütteln, dass über die deutsche Erfahrung und über deutsches Trauma und wie das unter Umständen auch an die Folgegeneration weitergegeben worden ist, dass darüber überhaupt gesprochen werden kann und gesprochen werden darf und versucht wird, da eine Sprache dafür zu finden. Also in diese Literaturgattung gehört er sicherlich dazu. Andererseits scheint das Buch, wie gesagt, in erster Linie auf Englisch und passt da dann wieder sehr gut in eine ähnliche Literatur der eigenen Genealogie und der Frage, was haben die Eltern gemacht, rein, was in Amerika eben jetzt auch wächst, wo die amerikanische Geschichte ja auch revidiert sich wird und die amerikanische Geschichte auch nicht mehr als so eine durchgehende Geschichte des Fortschritts in Richtung Demokratie geschrieben wird, sondern wo die Amerikaner sich eben auch mit den Schweinereien auseinandersetzen, die in ihrer Geschichte stattgefunden haben, mit Sklaverei, mit dem Genozid an den Ureinwohnern. Also, und deswegen funktioniert sein Buch, glaube ich, auch in Amerika, weil viele denken, okay, das ist eine Einwanderergeschichte und eine Spurensuche, die uns einerseits was sagt und andererseits aber auch was ganz anderes und was ganz Neues ist, sozusagen.
Ja,
Ja.
mit so schwierigeren, schmerzhafteren Themen, ne, wie Schuld und beteiligt sein, Verantwortung übernehmen müssen für Schmerz, für Gewalt, die man ausgeübt hat, ne? Und ja, das stelle ich mir auch sehr interessant vor, ob es ein etwas unbefangenerer Blick ist, den er hat, oder ob man vielleicht auch sagen würde, ja, vielleicht fehlt auch noch ein bisschen was bei ihm. Das wird man vielleicht in deinem Interview auch erfahren, wo du denkst, dass er vielleicht noch hätte weitergehen können, etwas vertiefen können. Oder kann man das jetzt noch nicht so vorwegnehmen?
Ja, man kann das auf jeden Fall vorwegnehmen. Also, was an dem Buch toll ist einerseits, ist, dass er eben sozusagen jegliches Wertende quasi vermeidet und so eine ganz tiefgehende Spurensuche ist und er sehr romanhaft und detailgenau diese sehr spannende und interessante Geschichte seines Großvaters auch erzählt. Andererseits er sich sehr zurücknimmt. Ne? Also er taucht dann als Person nur ganz punktuell auf da drin und vermeidet dann wiederum das, was viele Deutsche, die in dieser Literaturgattung arbeiten, dann stärker machen, nämlich zu fragen, ja, was hat es denn mit mir gemacht und wie ist es denn in meiner Generation angekommen, was ja dann für uns auch die Frage ist, die sich uns stellt und die uns beschäftigt. Also das hätte man sich mehr gewünscht. Andererseits ist es eben durch diese Detailgenauigkeit Und diese Rekonstruktion, wie gesagt, das liest sich wie ein Roman und liest sich unglaublich spannend und interessant, gerade aus der deutschen Perspektive auch. Ja.
Wie hat es denn die amerikanische Kritik aufgefasst bisher?
Ja, es ist, wie gesagt, es ist überraschend für viele. Und dieses Thema, was hier in Deutschland die Leute eben jetzt seit 15, 20 Jahren beschäftigt, das ist quasi die zweite und dritte Generation der Nazi-Nachfahren sich fragt, wie ist das bei uns angekommen und was hat es bei uns gemacht und demnach mit uns gemacht und wie bestimmt es auch unser Leben bis heute. Das ist, glaube ich, für Amerikaner ein ganz neues Thema und das finden die, hat die amerikanische Kritik schon sehr interessant gefunden, wie die Deutschen unserer Generation jetzt immer noch an dieser Vergangenheit knabbern und wie wir damit eben
auch
umgehen.
Ein Schweigen noch überwinden müssen, ne? Denn also bei allem, was man an Filmen, an Büchern, an Auseinandersetzungen mit dem Holocaust, mit der Shoah hat, ist, glaube ich, immer noch eben ein großer blinder Fleck, die Frage, wie wurden so viele zu Tätern und waren gleichzeitig normale Familienväter, ne? Also Fatherland heißt das Buch ja auch, ne? Das war ja eben dann nicht schwarz-weiß, als Familienväter waren sie trotzdem aufgetreten, ne? Und, oder hat man sie vielleicht eben als Kind dann überwiegend so wahrgenommen und muss dann erstmal damit vereinbaren, dass jemand vielleicht doch auch zu Grausamkeiten fähig war oder dieser Gehirnwäsche sich eben hat unterziehen lassen und man konnte ja dann nicht plötzlich jemand anders werden, sondern hat da auch was weitergegeben an seine Kinder.
Ja, ja, nee, und ich glaube, das ist jetzt auch spezifisch für, wie gesagt, unsere Generation, also die zweite Generation der Kriegskinder, dass die 68er ja sehr auch mit einer moralischen Gewissheit und sehr anklagend waren und gesagt haben, wo wart ihr und was habt ihr gemacht und was habt ihr gewusst? Und das war sicherlich notwendig in dieser Phase, aber dass bei uns da doch ein empathischerer Ton dann auch reinkommt und irgendwie ein vorsichtigeres Rangehen und ein Fragen, ja, wie hätte ich eigentlich gehandelt wo die Schuldfrage dann komplizierter wird und die lässt er auch so kompliziert und das ist auch sehr schön angekommen.
Ja. Klingt sehr spannend, dann kann man sich jetzt auf das Interview freuen.
Ja, vielen Dank.
You know, the nice thing has been that it's I've loved the range of responses. You know, I've gotten big, thoughtful reviews in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Times of London and the Economist and the Atlantic. So, like, really thoughtful, meaty, positive reviews. But then also just, like, all my high school friends from Oklahoma are reading it, you know, and I've gotten letters from people who just, like, German Americans who are reading it. So it's nice. It feels like it has maybe a broader audience than
than you thought it would have.
Well, then I would have known. You know, you never know.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm used to writing for this. The New Yorker is a big audience, but it's a very particular audience.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's nice to, anyway.
Yeah. I mean, do you get things like, why should we care about, you know, the plight of the grandchildren of Nazis?
I mean, sure, I think that's, you know, honestly, I think I get that more in Germany than I do in the United States. Yeah. In Germany, when I was researching, I would tell people my story, they'd say, oh, you should hear about my grandfather.
Right.
His story is much more dramatic than your grandfather's story,
right.
You know.
Yeah.
Whereas here, I think, it's especially now we're in this moment where people are re-examining our racist roots and our own, you know, Native American genocide and all that kind of stuff and kind of coming to terms with some of that. I think there's more people are interested in this idea of re-examining your roots. And so that makes sense to them.
That
working with that in your mind.
Yeah. I mean, from what I know, this topic is completely new to an American audience, like how the whatever trauma of, or the experience of Germans during World War II affected the next generation, how it's still...
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
No, I think it is. I mean, there was this, you know, there's been like in my piece for the New Yorker, I didn't go into this in the book, but mm-hmm. you know, there's been some research on intergenerational trauma, you know, even yeah. scientific research on in mice, and yeah. there you can show that there these things carry on physically. But yeah, I think the idea of even there was almost taboo to even think about mm-hmm. the victimization of Germans. Right. That was not something that people right. thought right. Yeah. was worthy of attention. Yeah. You know, yeah. so.
Yeah. As it was in Germany until yeah. 20 years ago, maybe.
Right, right.
Or so. Was that, did that keep you from diving into this for a long time? That you didn't want to think about that yourself, or you shied away from it? Or,
I did. I mean, I think, let me put this the right way. You know, I knew it was a topic that was very touchy in this country. As I say in my book, the idea of like talking about your German ancestry always immediately came with a certain reflexive judgment. You know, mm-hmm. oh, you're German, and if you say my grandfather was a Nazi, that's on top of that. It's already there's a certain assumption about Germanness. I think that was made. I think it's diminishing a bit, but I think that was certainly there. Mm-hmm. And so that was, I think. I was nervous about that. I think also, how to put this? I think part of me has always felt like there is no such thing as original sin, that we are not born guilty, that I've never had any kind of instinctive sense that I am personally responsible from my family's history. I haven't had that. Mm-hmm. But I did have this sense of this line carried through in my family. My mother was affected by it, was somewhat traumatized by it, was worried about it. And then as I started to see with my own kids how my history was wound up in them, I'd always been a little bit kind of, I always felt like a free agent, like I myself, and that I don't owe anything to anybody. But then when you start having kids, I think that just changed my perspective. And suddenly I thought, wow, this history is different, you know, and how is that going to play out? And has it played out in my character, and how will it play out in my children's?
Mm-hmm. So it was really the coming of age of your children, thinking about your children, that prompted you to want to dig into this.
Yeah, it was a combination of things. I think it was also, I mean, two things happened. I had kids and I started to think about intergenerational inheritance and legacy. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, these letters came from Alsace that my aunt sent. Mm-hmm. And those letters really, to see the handwriting of these villagers describing what my grandfather had done in the village during World War II. Mm-hmm. And to get a sense of the actuality of that history in his life, and also have a sense of, well, maybe there's a real story there that is worth digging into. I think those two things together made me think, mm-hmm. I really want to look into this.
Look into this, and that was when did that start? That interest, your sort of journey.
Yeah, I mean that happened. The letters came 2013. You know, mm-hmm. So I think part of what happened, I was still so involved with New Yorker pieces, and it took me a while to kind of get, but it was definitely both a personal pull and a journalistic pull. Part of me just thought there's a story here, you know, and I wanted to investigate that story.
Yeah. I mean, was it immediate to you that the story is the intergenerational trauma and this whole discourse of the Kinder der Kriegskinder? Mm.
No, that came later. I mean, I think the first story was simply, you know, I think of, you know, Nazi Germany is like a crime scene, and you're a detective. Like, is the guy guilty or not guilty? You know, that very simple frame mm-hmm. is the first thought. Mm-hmm. And to me, actually, because I'd grown up with this very black and white idea, the idea that actually there may be a Nazi who has multiple sides to it that is both. You know, right. It felt like a story I hadn't read, and it must obviously be true. There must be so many of these examples, and it felt like it's a story I hadn't read anymore.
Right.
It would so that appealed to me. The idea of of this complex character in a world that had always been described in such black and white terms for me.
Mm-hmm. So it was always clear that your grandfather was gonna, that's the story that you were looking for. Not your parents, not your whole family experience, but it was
really about my grandfather.
Yeah.
I mean, the hard part was, or the interesting part was, that I really didn't know what I would find. I mean, I had, you know, the letters to me were a strong evidence that he'd done some good things, you mm-hmm. know, kind of, and that incident with my mother and the old head of the resistance in the village, mm-hmm. you know. I knew that, but then I didn't know what else I would find. You know, I really didn't know if I would find out that, yes, he'd done those good things, but he'd also been, you know, a virulent anti-Semite, or he had participated in some war crimes of something. I didn't know it if I would find that. So that was still an open question mm-hmm. when I started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you, but you went into it sort of openly, not with this, like...
No, yeah, no, I would absolutely went openly. I mean, I think, you know, I think as a writer, you always imagine different plot lines, and some plot lines are better than others, mm-hmm. right? But I would have written whatever, I was ready to write whatever it came.
Right, yeah. So what are your personal recollections of your grandfather, and how did your image of him change throughout this investigation? I mean, I assume when you were a kid, you didn't know of his Nazi past, or you didn't know.
I didn't know his Nazi past, not really, not until I was a teenager that I did. I really know that in any way.
Yeah.
You know, I, as a little kid, he was kind of a spectral, kind of a ghost-like figure. You know, he was very stern and formal, always well-dressed, you know, polite, kind of grave, and, you know... he was nice to us. We would go have dinner at his house, and his second wife would bustle around and make us food. And like I say, he would talk to me, but he felt very kind of cerebral and distant. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is, when I talked to my German cousins, you know, who lived, some of my, the eldest cousins I have lived in the same town with him their whole childhood and saw him all the time. And they have the same impression. They don't really have any more impressions than I do of him. What was surprising when I did the research actually was to find out what a kind of a, like the Black Forest villagers and some of the people in the village in France, their recollections of him as a person are much looser and funnier and like kind of this earthy guy who you could talk to, who you could be relaxed with, and who was willing to talk straight. I mean, there was this kind of element of him mm-hmm. outside the family that I had not seen and that I hadn't heard of from the rest of my, mm-hmm. from my relatives, you know. So that was interesting. That, to me, if anything, that, you know, the Nazi figure, the kind of controlled, disciplined, by the book guy, I mean, that fit with the spectral guy that I knew, you know, kind of very formal.
Yeah.
But the other side of him that I think had been his before the war personality, that was, I hadn't seen before.
So you do think his personality changed?
I think so.
After the war, and how do you
absolutely
account for that? Is that this, you know, what a lot of Germans, I guess some people in other nations go through too, is this cut in the biography where you can't really integrate your past? Do you think that, I mean, I don't want to put words into your mouth, but do you think that that's what happened? Or that's
I do think so. I mean, I think he had an unimaginable series of traumas, right? Like, father commits suicide as a young boy. He goes to World War One, loses his eye.
As a 19-year-old.
Yes. He, you know, comes back. It's like the terrible, terrible depression, can't get a job. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, of course, after the war, he's in prison, almost dies in a prison camp, and then he gets in solitary confinement for a year and a half. I mean, I think that would leave a mark on anybody, regardless of the guilt or innocence of what happened along the way.
Yeah.
But I think it's also true that, as you say, no one talked about it. He couldn't talk. He didn't talk about it. There was no processing of this information.
Yeah.
The closest I could see to him processing it were the letters he wrote to his second wife when he was courting her. I mentioned those briefly at the end of the book, you know, where he kind of talked about his time in Alsace and told some stories. But that was not something you ever talked about with my mom or anybody else.
So, I mean, you talk about intergenerational trauma in the research you've done on it, and you talk about this incredible amount of trauma that your grandfather went through. Like, how do you think that manifested itself in your family and in your biography?
Well, that's interesting. I think my mother was certainly affected by it. I think she had a kind of a... I think she's by nature a very kind and positive soul, but I think there was always a certain darkness and pessimism there, I think, that came from her Schlebischhaut. She'd always say Schlebischhaut, you know? And I think for them, coming to the United States was all about escaping that. You know, and I think part of what happened, it's interesting, my wife's parents grew up in the United States and were in the Depression in Nebraska. And their reaction to that was very much to kind of the trauma of the American Depression was, you must always save, you know, live frugally, have a nest egg, have an escape thing, you know, have money saved up because, you know, you might hit the hard times. Mm-hmm. My parents, it was very much, doesn't matter what you do, disaster could just land out of a clear sky. You know, you could, things could, so just, so I think they were much more live for the moment, I think, because of the trauma in their background. Yeah. They were just like, there's no use in really being too careful.
Being too careful.
Yeah. And, you know, and I think different people react to that stuff differently, but that was their reaction.
And your parents were born, they were kids during in the war, right?
Born in 35, both born in 35.
Born in 35, so they were very,
very
young during the war.
Yeah.
No, it's so interesting that this talk about intergenerational trauma, and I think a lot of the research on that was done on Holocaust survivors,
right,
and
sure.
How it applies to Germans, and that what you're just talking about, that this, you know, you don't ever settle in, you know, you're always ready to leave. I think
right.
That's a very Jewish thing too.
Absolutely, absolutely. I do think for my parents it manifested in a positive way. I mean, they really I think also they had their little world around them. We have five kids, you know, they kind of you know, they built their own, created their own universe.
So I mean, you have a very empathetic view of your grandfather in the book. I don't know, how do you reconcile that with the Nazi part? Were you grappling with that, with guilt, or I suppose, you know, was there any lesson about the nature of evil or something like that?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think I'm empathetic in the book, but I try not to give him a pass. You know, I tried to very hard to me in writing it to kind of. I wanted to be empathetic to the human in him, but not soft pedal the things he did wrong. And I feel like he's an interesting character for me, because I feel like his strengths were also his weaknesses. You know, the things that made him become a Nazi, this ideological bent, this blinkered view of politics, this willingness to kind of turn a blind eye to some terrible things. He's just so fixated on other things. That same thing, I think, made him do some fairly courageous things later in life. Do I think that in any way exonerates him from that participation? Not really. Do I really think it... Does it make me feel the Nazis were any less terrible than they were? No. You know, it hasn't changed my view.
I mean, does it give you a deeper understanding of the nature of Nazism or fascism or totalitarianism?
I feel like when you do this kind of work, strangely, paradoxically, your view becomes both more black and white and more nuanced.
Yeah.
It becomes more black and white because you see the horrors up close. I had to actually see how in the village next to his, you know, children were sent to be euthanized. You know, I had to see exactly how what happened to the local Jews in the area surrounding. I had to see all of that stuff in living detail. You know, so or in Alsace, you know, when Struthof and seeing the death camp there. So you become those things become more stark, but at the same time, you look into the details of anybody's life, you start to see the nuance behind that and the ways in which, even in the midst of this, they made decisions that were good and bad all the time. Mm-hmm. So,
mm-hmm. He was a very early joiner, right?
I mean, fairly early, yeah, 33. I mean, depending on if you believe him, he said that his records was backdated, that he actually joined in 35, but the clerk said, anyway, there's this whole story. I don't know if it's true, but even 33 is still fairly early.
This was a very, very, I think, typical way into the Nazi party, or didn't you find that?
Yeah, I mean, elementary school teachers. And he went to the two Nuremberg rallies. I mean, he was not a mild participant.
He was gung ho.
Absolutely.
And that, of course, I mean, did he ever talk politics at home when you were, like, what were his politics after the war? Was he apolitical?
No, he was at SPD. He became a city councilman in Weiler Main for the Social Democratic Party.
Okay.
It's interesting. You know, there's like, you look through this at Nativitzilung's file, and the early stuff is all these judgments about his wartime activities, and then it progresses into him doing his political activity once he was in Nativitzilung, and, you know, and then it, by the end, you have these obituary things about him, his beloved city count. You know, it's like you see the, you know, to some degree, you see his evolution, to some degree, you see the whitewashing of German Nazi participation. You know, you see why the 68ers were so angry in the first place. It was people like, you know, not like him, but Nazis in general who were allowed to come back into society.
What did you find out about that switch? I mean, that always fascinates me. Stories of our parents and grandparents, like, you know, April 1945, you're still a Nazi, you know, like January 1st, 1946, you're a Social Democrat.
Right.
Like, how does that happen? What did you find out about that?
Well, you know, this gets at this question of what can you believe in his own testimonials. I mean, certainly there are letters in that Nativitzilung's file where he says, I was blind, I was duped, I made a mistake, you know, since then I've come back to the church, I've come back to democratic principles, you know, he says all these, he talks about a conversion experience he had, where he realized the errors of his ways, and I don't know, I mean,
everybody
said that, right? I mean, certainly, fundamentally, I don't think he was an evil man. I think he saw the evil outcomes of Nazi. I mean, that's not hard to believe that he saw that and realized he'd made a terrible mistake. Mm-hmm. What he actually thought about the Social Democrats and their policies, I never had that conversation. I don't remember my mom ever having that conversation with him. You know, I think it... it'd be interesting.
So you think he genuinely... like you say, saw his errors and saw the evil of the Nazi regime.
I think he genuinely saw that. I also feel like the Social Democrats fit some of what attracted him
to the Nazis
in the first place. The kind of, you know, obviously not the prejudicial stuff, but the things about more equitable distribution and more, you know, those kind of ideas.
All those things. I mean, in your encounters, I mean, you lived in Germany. You spent a lot of time in Germany. Do you feel that? I mean, I guess this is a sort of big question. But do you feel Germany has dealt sufficiently with the past?
I mean, I can only compare it to the United States. And I feel like, obviously, we didn't, you know, we have these deep things we need to deal with too, like Native American and Black history and other things. Yeah. But they're further back and not further back. No, let me start over. I feel like the United States has not come to terms with his history nearly as well. And part of what I admire about Germany is that it has been such a pacifist nation since the war. Yeah. I mean, there's this far right movement there, like in a lot of places. And you know, this is dangerous territory for me because my knowledge of German politics is going to be, you know, I don't have an expert knowledge of German politics today. My impression of Germany is that they had a deep self-examination and it had an effect on German culture in a dramatic way. And I loved, like in Berlin, we would go to plays with political talkbacks, you know, and there'd be strong political opinions, but they would be somehow not as self-righteous as political opinions here. If you get in a political debate in the United States, it often feels very polarized, very self-righteous, very loud. It instantly becomes, I'm right and you're wrong. Whereas I felt in Germany, it was more of a tendency to be cautious about that, to say, I have a strong opinion, but not necessarily be cautious of being too extreme.
Right.
And I think that's a good impulse. It's a good reflex to have.
No, it's interesting that you're seeing that, you know, like growing up in Germany, I always feel like Germans are still way too opinionated.
Oh, really?
Still think they know better than everybody else. Yeah.
Well, it may be that I was in Berlin and I was seeing a version of that that's different from Munich or something. Yeah. You know?
But at the same time, I mean, you spend a lot of time in rural Germany where you would expect that the self-examination wasn't as deep and as thorough, but the characters that you meet, it seems like, you know, that there was a genuine and a very, very profound sort of way of having dealt with the past.
I felt so. I definitely felt so. I admired it. And then when I started to see the far right coming back and Antifa and all that stuff, it was scary. But again, I think it's less than Hungary or Austria or Poland or any number of areas around there. It still feels like it's mute. There's a cautiousness there about that. France, you know, even so.
Yeah, it's terrifying. So yeah. I mean, growing up in Oklahoma, I mean, I think you write in the book that you spoke German or Alemannisch at home.
Alemannisch, yeah.
Alemannisch.
Yeah. I'm just gonna close this door. Yeah, my parents, you know, they had grown up speaking Alemannisch together, and I think they just, and they loved the dialect, and so I think they that was for them home. Mm-hmm. So they wanted to speak that with us.
Yeah.
But no High German. We didn't learn Hochdeutsch at all.
Yeah. That's a very funny passage in the book where you start your research and you learn that you only know how to speak Alemannisch and you have to learn your High German to communicate with all these archives.
Oh my God! And going to Germany, like often I feel like if I'm in Berlin, I try to speak Alemannisch to people. They look at me like, "Why are you speaking this weird dialect to me?" And if I try to speak Hochdeutsch, I just sound like an idiot. They just feel like, well, he doesn't have much of an accent, but he's just dumb. You know? So it's like, okay. He's making all these grammatical errors.
But I guess, the question is, did you have a strong sense of your German heritage, your German background when you grew up in Oklahoma, that you were like different, that you were...
I definitely did, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we were... You know, a family of seven speaking German in the middle of, I mean, nobody I know. There were a lot of German history in Oklahoma, but it was not, it was all deep buried. You know, my mother did her master's thesis on German-American newspapers in Oklahoma.
Oh.
And they had, and I think there had been seven of them up until 1914, up until World War I, essentially. And they all got disbanded and the newspaper editors got tarred and feathered and kicked out of town. And so there had been a very strong German American culture there, and then that kind of disappeared. Right. So we were an anomaly.
Yeah. So you had a sense of your German background early on, but when did you think you started putting that together with the more recent history, the more German history, and asking those questions, how did that affect us or me?
Not until late, yeah. Because when we were growing up, it was very much kind of deep German culture, like Weihnachtslieder, tradition, German traditions. It was, and lots of stories. The stories my mother told would be about the Black Forest or about the food or about, what winters were like. It was all this kind of, it could have been 200 years earlier instead of
right.
30 years earlier, right. Yeah. So I don't think I really started to connect it to German politics and modern German history until I was, in college.
Yeah, okay.
So, came late.
Interesting. So the German identity wasn't linked with the Nazi past?
No, not at all.
That early.
No, yeah. not at all. I mean, I think, my parents' stories were, my father's stories, but like they were in school together, and they were in the same classmates all from like 12 until they graduated in Abitur. So it was all about their professors, or my father would talk about playing soccer after school, or my mother would talk about the times in the Black Forest. It was apolitical, that conversation, very much so.
So do you see this? I mean, there is this literature of Kinder der Kriegskinder that's sort of exploding almost in Germany in the past 10 years. I mean, where do you see yourself as part of that, but also bringing, this outside perspective to it as an American?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, now I do. It's interesting, I came to Berlin completely unaware of the Kriegskinder movement. Uh-huh. Midway through my year in Berlin, this would have been 2015, I went to Familienabstellung.
Yes, I read that.
And then I got in touch with Sabine Bode, and I talked and went to the Kriegskinder Konferenz and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, at that point,
I'm sorry.
it was actually kind of a wonderful thing in a way to find that so many people were engaged in the same thing I was. Mm-hmm. And I think for the same reason, to some degree, like we all kind of realized this was the moment, the people were almost dead. The only way to find this stuff out was now.
Yeah.
It's almost too late, but we could still do it.
Yeah. But I mean, I think what held people back in Germany for a long time is this, like, this, are we even allowed to talk about this? Are we allowed to talk about German suffering,
Right.
Was that ever an issue for you? for you?
It was... I mean, I think the issue for me was exactly that I thought you should be able to talk about that. And I, it was always a cautious endeavor for me. I always was well aware of the dangers in doing this.
Right.
And I always wanted to be, I didn't want to sound defensive. I didn't want to sound contrarian or I wanted to look at that history and my grandfather's history with an open mind. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to silence myself because you aren't allowed to talk about this.
Right.
But I also didn't want to be weighed into it saying, damn it, it's time we talked about our own, I didn't want to do that either. I wanted to walk, it was a very narrow line to walk, but I wanted to walk that line.
Yeah, what's the solution? I mean, I from reading your book, it seems like your solution was to just tell the story.
Yeah.
In as much detail and nuance as possible.
But, yeah. I think that was ultimately to me, it was sticking to the facts, being as open with the facts as I could be, not trying to be an apologist, not try to interpret the facts to in my grandfather's favor, but also not trying to reflexively judge him, to like say, okay, who is this guy? what did he do, you know? And I do feel like that was part of why it took me 9 years to write this book, was I really wanted to have the details. I needed to find all the archival material. I needed to interview the people. I needed all that to be able to even to write it.
I mean, you found it. That's incredible, the amount of detail you were able to put together about, you know, events in these villages. Yeah, that was an incredible.
I mean, I wanted to write it at some level novelistically, like, you know, but I did not want to make things up. I didn't want to fictionalize. I didn't want to do what The Crown does or other, you know, modern fictionalized autobiographies. I wanted to have everything rooted in specific facts.
I mean, you think the story is, I mean, the story is about your grandfather, but the story is also your quest and your search, right?
Sure.
Is there one that's more important to you?
No, I mean, you know, I think if I could have written this, if he'd been a different person, if he'd been someone who was famous or he'd had vivid diaries or if he'd had a million letters where everything was explained, if I could have, and if there was a whole literature around him of other people's perspectives on him that I could draw on, then my instinct as a New Yorker writer, I mean, if you look at my pieces, I'm almost never that present in my pieces. You know,
as you are in the book.
As I am in the book. I think in that case, I would have written this book that way, as truly novelistic description of this man, and using these different sources. Didn't have those sources. So so I think part of it just became the drama of finding them, you know, and what that means. What does it even mean to to research a man like this, you know? I mean, ultimately, I hope that's one of the things that makes the book worthwhile, is it's about a nobody, right? It's about a man who was just a small town school teacher.
Right, yes.
And because it's so hard to write those stories, there aren't as many of them around.
It's much harder than if he would have been an SS man in Auschwitz,
because
then it's the guilt question is not very complex. So I mean, did you have primarily an American audience in mind, and or were you doing this more, you know, because it's a good story, or Americans to understand this?
No, I had an American audience in mind, I think. I mean, I have always assumed at some point it'll be read by Germans and French. It's being translated in various languages. But
is it being translated into German?
I sold the contract to a German publisher, and then I took so long that they canceled it. But it hasn't gone to a German publisher yet.
Oh, okay.
It's like Italian, Dutch, Chinese, Portuguese.
The book took so long that they lost patience with it?
They lost patience in it, yeah.
Okay.
It's a shame. I mean, I imagine it'll get translated one of these days.
Yeah.
But not yet. So it's interesting.
Yeah.
But yeah, I always had an American audience in mind. I think partly because I think, as you said, this is not something that Americans know as well. They don't know this side of German history or this kind of a story. I think it's just not part of their upbringing. I mean, the movies and their view of German World War II history is pretty reductive.
Yes. So you want to get beyond Hogan's here. Okay, great. Thank you.
Sure.
Very, very, very interesting.
Yeah.
And the book was fascinating to me, especially because there's this, you know, this coincidence that, you know, my family was like 5 miles away from your family during World War II.
So what town were they in?
In Celesta.
Oh, yeah.
My grandfather took over a French sawmill. So,
oh. Yeah. And tell me about his family. What do you know of his his experience?
Oh, he'd been he was like running sawmills all over southern Germany. I think, I mean, I haven't done that deeper research. I think he was always somehow working for the Festenbergs.
Yeah.
They had wood everywhere.
Right.
Where they moved them around a lot. you know, I don't know. I mean, I'm assuming that when the Nazis took over Alsace and they gave the whole wood business to the Fürstenbergs and they took their grandfather the drums.
Yeah. Interesting. Wow.
Yeah, it is interesting. A while, so yeah. I guess
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. I like it that you found so many programs. I just love his book and the illustration. It's so beautiful.
That is an amazing book.
Ja, das war 212, der Amerika-Podcast aus New York. Heute mit meiner Co-Hostess Sabine Baumann und mit dem New Yorker Autor Burkhard Bilger über sein neues Buch Fatherland. Vielen Dank fürs Reinhören. Euch allen einen wunderschönen Sommer und bis ganz bald.